Theater, PBS. I am Alistair Cook. I'm dating myself. I loved Alistair Cook on that. I still miss Alistair Cook. I love it. So. Second son by a different mother, Yvonne. And Yvonne is the intellectual. He is the academic. He publishes pamphlets about God and justice and has proclaimed that if there is no immortality or belief in immortality, then, quote, everything is permitted. And that statement. Everything is permitted is one of the things that has resonated from the time of the Brothers Karamazov through the rest of the 19th century and into the 20th century. If there is no immortality, meaning if there is no sense of ultimate meaning, if this life is all there is, then how do we choose to live our lives? What is it that really governs our lives? And the implication for Dostoevsky is really it's every person for themselves. Why not? So everything is permitted. So this is a huge question. And I was talking a little bit about this yesterday, and of course, this is what leads to not too many decades afterwards. You have Friedrich Nietzsche, thus spoke Zarathustra, and the whole God is dead notion, and then into the 20th century, existentialism and responses to that. And Dostoevsky is often thought of as a kind of father to this kind of thinking. So that's Ivan. And the third son is Alyosha, who's the youngest son. And as in fairy tales, we know something about youngest sons. They are traditionally thought of at times as kind of fools, but they are the ones who are sent out last by the father to attempt some kind of quest that it seems impossible to complete. But the youngest son is the one who actually completes it, solves the problem, marries the princess, and lives happily ever after. It's kind of curious, really. I'm now digressing, which is appropriate, because that's what we've been doing anyway, that's what Dostoevsky does. But often, I've read a lot of fairy tales to my daughter when she was young. We went through a lot of Grimm and Hans Christian Andersen and the Andrew Lang red, blue, purple, pink fairy tale books. And so often, it really is a youngest son, and he succeeds by paying attention to the small animals. We get a little bit of this even in Disney versions of this, but in the fairy tales, that's what often happens. That is, the youngest son is on a quest, and you'll see this digression actually ties into what we've been talking about. The youngest son is set forth, and there is a particular aim in mind. And along the way, along the road, he comes upon, it might be an ant, or a butterfly, or a squirrel, or something. And this small creature is having trouble. And so the youngest son stops and helps them out. And of course, in the world of fairy tales, these creatures talk. And they say to the youngest son, hey, if you ever need any help, just let us know. And of course, there's always this sort of joking quality. I mean, you're an ant. I'm a human being. How could you possibly help? But they get to the castle, and then there's some huge task that has to happen. You have to move this pile, this mountain, from one place to this place. The youngest son is in despair. How am I possibly going to do that? And then, of course, what happens is an army of ants or swallows or flies or whatever shows up and moves the mountain from one place to another. The miracle takes place through this natural force. And Alyosha is a little bit like that kind of fairy tale hero. So Alyosha is the youngest son. And I did digress for some plot summary here. Welcome. And there are some copies plugging around back there. Dimitri and his father Theodore are having a quarrel. And it's partly over land and money. And it's partly over a woman named Grushenka. Both of whom love, both father and son love Grushenka. And Grushenka is the fallen woman. To pick up from where Peter was this morning, she's the woman at the well, would be one way of putting it. She is the outcast. She's very much the outcast. In comparison to her, there's Katrina, who is the aristocrat, the well-schooled, the educated, the one who knows how to do the right things the right way. So there's Katrina versus Grushenka. So that's the basic plot line. And yesterday, we hit the story of the Grand Inquisitor. Anybody want to try to summarize where we were at? What that's all about? That's what I figured.
Can we do it by group?
Sure. Yeah. Just pick up threads of it. That's interesting. What do you remember?
I'm trying to think of how it relates to the larger story. Maybe.
Well, what I remember is Jesus is coming up for trial a second time, sort of. Was it Grand Inquisitor?
Yes. Yeah.
Has Jesus in front of him.
Yeah. Jesus shows up in 16th century Spain, which is the time when the Inquisition is taking place. And there's this extraordinary repression on the part of the Roman Catholic Church. And Jesus shows up. He's walking in the streets of this city. And there is a young girl who has just died. And Jesus goes, and there's one word that Jesus says. And she comes back to life. Jesus has returned. And the Grand Inquisitor, who is the cardinal of the city, arrests him. We can't have this kind of behavior going. You're ruining everything, just like you did before. Just like you did before. And then that you get the essentially a kind of sermon on behalf of the Grand Inquisitor, which is also kind of interesting. It's not Jesus who speaks and gives the sermon on the Mount. It's the Grand Inquisitor who speaks. He has the word. He has the word. And the word is, you blew it 1,600 years ago by allowing people freedom. That's the primary notion. You gave people too much freedom. They can't handle it. They say they want it, but they don't really want it because it's just too much to take. Choice, good and evil. If you just give them miracle, mystery, and authority, if you give them bread, you take stone and turn it into bread and feed them, they will be happy. They will be content. And you can give them the illusion of freedom, fine, but not the real thing. And what we're saying yesterday again is, of course, this sets the stage for what we think of as the 20th century dystopian novel. Brave New World, 1984, being probably the best known among them. And really what Dostoevsky's getting at in a very central way is a fundamental question about our lives and how we want to live it. I often teach Homer's Odyssey, and there's a scene in the Odyssey, famously, where Odysseus's men go out, get off of this island, and it's the island of the Lotus Eaters. And the Lotus Eaters land, it's beautiful. This is, let's call it an Aegean island. It's peaceful, it's quiet. And the people spend all day eating the lotus, which is essentially a form of opium. And they are so happy.
Fahrenheit 451.
Same deal. Same, absolutely the same deal. And let me know if you can't hear me. Okay? Thank you. I'm remembering. Yeah. And it's a really interesting question because, of course, what Odysseus does is he gets the rest of his men and he grabs the sailors who've gone on the shore and have been eating the lotus and who want to stay there. And he literally, bodily lifts them up, carries them back on the ship, and then sets out for Ithaca, which is home. And the question I always ask is, why not stay in Lotus Land? why not stay? Let's call it Holden. Assuming that you don't have to pay, I mean, I don't know. And it's not a bad analogy in a way. I mean, Eric's sitting here, and I've not spent a long stretches of time, but one of the things I understand, I think this is fair, correct me, but it can be a place where people can, in a sense, hide out. I mean, they can, rather than continuing to, you know, whatever we mean by that, is that fair? Is there some sense of that as a risk here?
I think that can be a risk, yeah.
Yeah. Because it's just, obviously, terrific here.
The journey is what it's about, not staying.
Well, see, that's the question. Why? Where are we trying to get to?
Staying's not all it's cracked up to be.
You've got Lotus. Let's translate it. You've got
flat screen.
Movies, you've got flat screen, you've got really good Chardonnay or Sauvignon Blanc or Merlot or maybe single malt scotch. You've got the gym. You've got a really nice condo up above Pike Place Market in Seattle.
What's freedom?
Yeah, okay. And that's, you know, that's
what you've got is you.
Yeah. You've got yourself. And at least my experience is that sooner or later, paradoxically, that sense of just staying put really turns out to be running away from something. There's something that it just finally doesn't work. It doesn't work. I'm not finally set unless I keep myself sufficiently drunk. And of course, this is the nature of an addiction. And I deal with this with students all the time. Yeah.
I have a clarifying question about the story of the Grand Inquisitor and how it's involved in the novel. Is Yvonne kind of retelling the story to Alyosha and kind of comparing what his philosophy is about society at that time, or how did that come in? I think I lost that part yesterday.
Okay, yeah, and thank you, because that is also where I want to pick up. And let's see if I can weave these two pieces together. Yvonne has said, I want to hand back my ticket to God. He entirely rejects God's world because of the suffering of children, is the primary thing. So Yvonne is somebody who feels that torment, is clearly tortured himself, and has not found a way to satisfy, to take care of that pain, whether it's through, I mean, Dimitri drinks a lot and so on and so forth. There are a number of different ways we try to deal with some fundamental trauma or suffering that we feel in our life. However outwardly wonderful our lives are, I think most of us, if not all of us, have some sense of fallenness or brokenness. There is some brokenness. And this is often where I start almost all of my classes. My colleagues joke about, you know, Doug studies. It's like it's all, whatever I teach, is all the same thing.
That's true of all professors.
That's probably right. You know, a minor in Doug studies. But it's because I always seem to start out with, we're broken. What are we going to do about that? And if you think about literature, to a great extent, that's the situation. There's this situation here, and then there's a journey, a plot, a narrative that moves towards some kind of reconciliation or healing. If it's comedy, it will tend to move towards marriage, which is not just about the two people, but about a larger community as well, in a Shakespearean comedy. If it's tragedy, the difference between Midsummer Night's Dream and Romeo and Juliet is a thin line, very thin, because Romeo and Juliet could easily end up as a comedy. But it ends up as a tragedy. But the tragedy is also, through those two people, healing that community. So most of the tragedies, there is some kind of deep woundedness in individuals and in society that has to be healed. How does that healing come about? That's always the question. And I'm not forgetting your question. Because Yvonne, that's Yvonne's dilemma. And he's trying to figure out a way to heal it. And his answer is, in part, the story of the Grand Inquisitor. And one of the things that is always raised is the Grand Inquisitor chapter is often excerpted and put in anthology separately. And I think it became pretty clear yesterday that what you lose by that is that, in fact, the story of the Grand Inquisitor, which is so powerful, and comes in the context of Yvonne telling Alyosha all these stories about the suffering of children. And I related just one of them. And I think that it just kind of sat there. And that's so important, that we feel the weight of that. That we can't solve that problem directly. And again, what I said yesterday is that this very moment, that's occurring someplace. And if we open ourselves to that, what do you do with it? And that's what Yvonne is dealing with. What Yvonne says to Alyosha before he tells the story is, maybe I'm telling you all this because I want to be healed by you. And so, in fact, the story of the Grand Inquisitor, the real purpose in terms of the narrative is, this is Yvonne's story. Yvonne is that wounded child, is that suffering child who desperately needs healing. Dmitri is that wounded child. Alyosha, in some ways, we're all that wounded child that needs healing. And this is the one moment Yvonne actually acknowledges it. There is that he has enough trust or openness with Alyosha because of Alyosha's character that he's actually able to say that. It's an extraordinary moment. And it's so revealing. And you can probably think of people that you know, and it may be yourself, who present a kind of exterior persona to the world that is kind of unbreakable. But if you get to know them, then maybe there's this moment where suddenly this person shows up. And it's so powerful. And that's what happens with Yvonne. He really shows up. Maybe I want to be healed by you. So this is the frame. And at the end of it, he tells the story, and what happens? The story ends with...
with Jesus giving the Grand Inquisitor a kiss,
yes,
and walking out.
Right, yeah. The Inquisitor, rather than killing him again, says, go, I never want to see you again. Mm-hmm. That's essentially how the story ends. Yes, he gives the Inquisitor a kiss. He says not a word. Silence. And that silence weighs on us. The implication is that there really is nothing that Christ can say to the arguments that the Inquisitor is making. Christ is, in a sense, silent in the face of the suffering child. That is just so huge. And we so desperately want to fix that or soften it. I was talking after class with a couple of people who reminded me of my experience often at where I teach, which is an evangelical Christian university. And often what happens is if a student has suffered some kind of tragedy, I had one student whose sister had died, 20-year-old sister, just recently married, and had died and hit by a car. Just was standing on the curb and had stepped off and was hit by a car, her sister. And this had happened 6 months, something like that, before. And the response that other students often gave her when they heard this story was sincerely meant, but it was along the lines of, well, she's with Jesus now. Mm. And what's your response to that?
That's an awful thing to say to people.
But why?
Because it's
it completely discounts
their pain.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. This is what my student experienced. absolutely what makes people experience. And I was fortunate enough to, and I don't know how this happens, but I do a lot of one-on-one work with students in my office. And you know, it's often it's like you pull just a tiny thread and suddenly there it is. There it is. There's the story. And it was, I'm grateful. She graduated a couple of years ago. We're good friends still. But that was the situation. There really aren't words at that moment. There aren't words. There's a beautiful story Parker Palmer tells. He entered a period of extreme depression. I mean, this is one of the most successful educators, wonderful writer, so on. He talks in one of his books about going through a period of extreme depression. And he was at home one day. And, you know, people would come over and do what people do. You're depressed? Go for a run. Get out. Make friends. It's all well meant. Right? And, of course, you just want to kind of shoot. Don't understand. And instead, one friend came over and simply came in the house and told Parker Palmer to put his feet up. He took off his shoes and socks, and he massaged his feet. That's all he did. Not a word. And then quietly left. And that was, of course, Christ. Yeah. And so Alyosha is trying to find ways to do that. And so he kisses Yvonne in response to Yvonne's story as well. And that's where we leave the story of the Grand Inquisitor. On the one hand, there is no answer to Yvonne's comments. There's no answer to that suffering child. And a lot of people who read the book take that as the core message of this book. There is no God. There is no ultimate meaning. Children suffer. And what are we going to do? How do we choose to live? Camus, in his collection of essays, The Myth of Sisyphus, nails it as well as anybody that I know. What Camus says is, there's only one really important question. It's the question of suicide. And that's what's so wonderful about Camus. Thomas Merton wrote extensively about Camus, his great Trappist monk. Many essays about Camus. He loved the work of Camus because he could feel Camus as this honest soul wrestling with the big questions in a very deep way.
So is that Kirillov and the Possessed, as we say that same thing?
Yeah, that's right. And he makes that choice. Yeah.
But in the play, Ryu says, I don't know, I just have to fight the play, even though I'm spreading it, maybe. I'll take that leap. And what motivates that?
The play, it's such a wonderful book, and it really is Camus talking to Dostoevsky and the Brothers Karamazov. Mm-hmm. And the plague is this metaphor for what we're all living in. Mm-hmm. There is a plague among us, and what do? And all these different characters have different solutions. I'm going to go drink, I'm going to go gamble, I'm going to ignore it as well as I can. And then you've got a few who say, the plague is here, I can't solve it, but... And there's no real reason to do anything except some internal sense that I am choosing to fight the plague. Right? And that is a heroic statement on the part of those characters. But that's not where Dostoevsky leaves us. Not at all. Instead, you've got Alyosha and the kiss as a response to really the dilemma about freedom. Remind us that the epigraph to the novel is from John 12:24. Verily I say unto you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. Now how ridiculous is that? How paradoxical is that? And yet we know in terms of a natural cycle, that's absolutely true. If seeds do not get buried, if there is not compost, et cetera, et cetera. The whole system is set up this way. And one can either say, well, that's part of a fallen system, and ultimately there'll be no death, which, you know, may be true. But one might also say that this cycle is really a kind of metaphor for the way ultimate reality works. That is the nature of God, at least demonstrated through Christ. What Christ seems to demonstrate is that the nature of love, the nature of ultimate reality is, I offer myself for you. Why am I doing this? It's not in order to earn points. It's not because my mother said that I should do it, or I'm going to be punished because if I don't do it. None of that. And again, it's a good exercise to just think and write, if I have had that experience, really, of that kind of complete love, where I really just want to give something. Yeah.
But isn't this Bonhoeffer's answer?
Say more. You want me to riff on Bonhoeffer now?
But I mean, isn't that really what he's saying when he says,
yes,
you know, I have chosen to do this. This is what I have chosen to do.
Yes. Yes.
And I don't want to do it. But this is what I feel I must do.
Yes. Yeah. And for Bonhoeffer, of course.
Bonhoeffer's, and that was his answer, not saying it's everyone's.
No. But surely Bonhoeffer's answer, and for those unfamiliar, Bonhoeffer, a Lutheran pastor who is imprisoned during World War II and executed by the Nazis. And Bonhoeffer's answer, and I'm not a Bonhoeffer expert for sure, but it's not Camus' answer. It's closer, I'd say, to Dostoevsky's answer. That is, there is some fundamental act of love that leads him to do what he does. You know, the one thing I remember from my early college days of reading Bonhoeffer was his expression, cheap grace. He just hated this notion of cheap grace. And cheap grace is like my students saying to you who are suffering a tragedy, it's okay. Jesus loves you, or whatever. Cheap grace. And Bonhoeffer obviously really knew something about the cost of grace. That is, the cost is your life. But
how is that different from Camus and suicide?
Well, it's different than the suicide, I suppose. And we actually need to get to the novel eventually. But this is what the novel does. You know, it walks us into these huge questions. The suicide is an act of defiance, in part, or despair, or whatever it might be. And Camus' answer, I mean, this is what Merton was wrestling with in a way. Certainly from Camus' point of view, it was an act done not with some sense that there's ultimate meaning or God or whatever.
But there is no other alternative.
Or for that person, or
you create your own meaning,
yes,
by your existential decision.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's the world he wants to live in.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, that's right. Kind of like Dimitri's earlier thing about, you know, like there's nobility in simply, you know, standing there on the mountaintop.
Yeah.
Regardless, it doesn't mean anything, or, you know.
That's right.
There's just the pain itself is like an emblem of honor or something.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And what I want to do, and did I answer your question?
Yeah, it's
good.
Clear now.
Good.
Thank you.
Okay.
Very much.
Okay. And where this takes us really is the question of freedom. Somebody was pointing out to me last night, I've been sitting in the class, and just sort of casually said, oh, you should read 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 17 and on. So I did. Here it is. Now, the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. And all of us, with unveiled faces, seeing the glory of the Lord as though reflected in a mirror, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord, the Spirit. That's pretty powerful. This is the nature of freedom. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. When we think of freedom in this country, probably most of us go to a legal definition. So freedom within a legal context would suggest what? What do you mean by freedom?
Just another word for nothing else to do.
The gospel according to Chris Christopherson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Freedom is just another word.
Nothing left to lose.
Nothing left to lose. So.
Nothing left to lose. Yeah. Yeah. More Bob Dylan. You ain't got nothing. You got nothing to lose. You're invisible now. You got no secrets to conceal. And that's one of those places that we go. So freedom. You got any attorneys, any lawyers in the house?
I wonder about one of the questions that in reading that, you know, is what then is the spirit? What is our assumption of what the spirit is and what it does? And does it kill us? See, I think that's...
Does it kill us?
Will it kill us? Does it kill us?
What do you think? I mean, we're told the letter kills and the spirit gives life. All right. But...
Spirit leads us to death. That will life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the only way... And this again is this endless Christian paradox that Dostoevsky in turn is playing. Up and down, high and low, life and death. And the only way, apparently, to true life, up there, metaphorically, is by going down into the earth, in a literal sense, through death. But I think in a more figurative sense, that is a psychological, emotional, spiritual sense, there is some kind of act of surrender that love makes possible.
Bonhoeffer, in the language of his time, when Christ calls a man, Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die.
Yes.
That's the beginning of that book, Discipleship.
Okay, yes. Yeah, bids him come and die. Yeah, what a splendid invitation.
But that's exactly what it is, and that's freedom. It's invitation.
It is.
The cross is that which you are under no earthly compulsion to pick up. You can choose it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And this, of course, is what Ivan is fighting against. He is holding on to his rebellion. You could call it a kind of tantrum, which two-year-olds experience, but really each of us still experiences. When a tantrum is when I'm not getting my way, and I'm not willing to kind of let go of the fact that I'm not going to get my way. So Yvonne is having a really long, intense tantrum against the way things are, against reality. He's going to hold on. He's going to hold on against that.
Yeah. One of the parts of the story that intrigues me, and in my mind kind of connects with the rest of the novel, is that Ivan himself, even though he sees himself as the Grand Inquisitor, sort of, giving back his ticket, but ultimately he still admires Christ's grace and love, and having the Grand Inquisitor be kissed at the end.
Yeah,
so it's like, later they get into this discussion, is Ivan an atheist or not? Now you have to argue that he's not, just because he still seems to be holding on to this hope that maybe Jesus can pull him out.
And this is why the elder Zosima, the sort of saint-like figure of the novel, says early on to Ivan, you are tormented by either, your desire to actually believe and then your unwillingness to go there. And you're going to remain tormented as long as you're indecisive about it. But your heart will never allow you to rest in a state of rebellion. It will never allow you to rest there. As much as you may want that, and praise God for such a heart. And that is very much Ivan. And as the novel is unfolding, we're seeing all these different tracks, these different threads. What's going to happen with Dmitri? What's going to happen with Ivan? Where's Alyosha going to go? And there's a feeling of we're coming to some kind of crisis point. The elder Zosima is dying. Dmitri and Fyodor are in this quarrel, and it's gotten to such a temperature that Dmitri is talking about killing his father. And then Yvonne is somewhere out there willing to just let them fight it out. So there is a crisis coming in the novel. And again, that crisis is a microcosm of what Dostoevsky was experiencing in Russia in the late 1870s. He could feel it. It was so intense. And as I've said, the Tsar was assassinated in 1881, the year Dostoevsky dies. And transplant that, and I love teaching this novel because I think maybe it's always there's some sense of crisis, but certainly we're living in a time of transformation, potentially, I think. That's my own feeling. And the question is, okay, how do we respond to this? What's the best way to deal with it? The book after The Grand Inquisitor, Dostoevsky divides the entire Brothers Karamazov into 12 books, perhaps not coincidental. And the one after The Grand Inquisitor focuses on the Elder Zosima. And I said that when Dostoevsky sent a letter to his publisher, having just finished this section of the novel, The Grand Inquisitor, he says, I've written something where the injustice of God is irrefutable. And now I'm going to refute it. It's typical. That is, there's a logical claim. Irrefutable means, logically, that it can't be refuted. But then presumably, the refutation is going to have to come in something other than logic, debate, and argument. As we've already seen with Zosima, so that would make sense. Just as the Kiss of Christ is the answer to the Grand Inquisitor, which is no answer in one sense. And if you're someone who is just really pissed at God, that kiss may not satisfy you. I certainly had a lot of students who say, no, no way. And that's Yvonne. But part of Yvonne is the kiss itself. I mean, these students are also caught in that same place. So what we get with the Elder Zosima, and I'll just read you a little snippet of this. This is from the Talks and Homilies of the Elder Zosima. Much of this book, Book 6, is just a story about the Elder and some of his own words. So here's what he says. Zosima, fathers and teachers, what is a monk? In the enlightened world of today, this word is now uttered in mockery by some, and by others even as a term of abuse, and it gets worse and worse. True, among monks there are many parasites, pleasure seekers, sensualists, insolent vagabonds. Educated men of the world point this out, saying, you are idlers, useless members of society, shameless beggars, living on the labors of others. And yet, among monks, so many are humble and so on and so forth. So the argument is, the question is, what's the function of a monk? What good are you? What good are you? Right. From an enlightened standpoint, call it a Western European standpoint, the monk seems to be utterly useless. There's a wonderful chapter in a book of Kathleen Norris's. I think it's in Dakota, actually. Kathleen Norris, familiar with her work? Wonderful book, Dakota. She had been living in New York, moves back to the Midwest where her family was, and gets connected up with a Benedictine monastery out there in the middle of nowhere, Dakotas. And she has a chapter called Degenerate Art, and she makes an analogy between what the Nazis called degenerate art, which was modern art, essentially, and monks. Makes a connection. Poetry. What good is poetry? What good is literature? Well, it's just like the life of a monk. It appears to be utterly useless according to society's standards. But of course, her point is that somewhere in that idleness, there is something very powerful going on. And this too is speaking to our experience at Holden. Mine is which gives us an opportunity to be idle for a little bit, to slow down, which I know I resist. I just want to read the next book or whatever it might be. And it's a little bit like the structure of the novel as a whole. The novel is a narrative. There's a plot. And we're anticipating the unfolding of something significant. It's going to be a murder or who knows what. If we're reading for the plot, this whole book about the elder Zosimo is going to drive us crazy.
Yes.
Where was that?
Sorry, that was
yeah. Oh, isn't that right?
Voice from above.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You just want to skip it. You're going to skim the surface like, oh, man, it's like not really a dialogue in here. This is not developing the plot. It's just like the digressions we've been talking about. What's the point of these, the story about the elder Zosima and his homilies, for goodness sake? What's the point? Idlers.
We wanted to publish them somewhere.
I guess that's
right.
Yeah,
you're getting paid to write,
yeah, if you're getting paid by the word, you stick in whatever you can.
Get a friend, you know.
Yeah. This is what Zosima says. I think about the monk. Can my thinking be false? Can it be arrogant? Look at the worldly and at the whole world that exalts itself above the people of God. They have science. And in science, only that which is subject to the senses. But the spiritual world, the higher half of man's being, is altogether rejected, banished, with a sort of triumph, even hatred. The world has proclaimed freedom, especially of late. But what do we see in this freedom of theirs? Only slavery and suicide. For the world says, you have needs, therefore, satisfy them. You have the same rights as the noblest and richest men. Do not be afraid to satisfy them, but even increase them. This is the current teaching of the world, and in this they see freedom. But what comes of this right to increase one's needs? This is a real curious dilemma. Because it can, on the one hand, it can sound like, oh, Zosima behind him, Dostoevsky, has no interest in individual rights. I actually thought about joining Sunitha's session, putting them together today, because she's really been wrestling with this question about Western culture and this incredible emphasis on the individual and individual rights. Freedom. That's how we understand freedom. And it can sound like Dostoevsky is completely dismissing that, and he's not. Not elsewhere in the novel, he's quite clear. I mean, Dostoevsky had a strong sense of the individual standing up for him or herself, and, you know, against really the rest of society. But the question is he onto something here? Right? If we're simply focusing on individual rights, and you know, I've got a need and it's my right to satisfy it, where is that going to lead? And of course, he's also looking at what he would define as a capitalist society, a capitalist system, which is based on these kinds of questions. The individual, and a bunch of individuals, all of whom want something, they will determine market value and so on. So this is what he's raising. You have needs satisfied. You have the same rights as a nobleman. And of course, that's true. And so how do you solve this question of freedom and rights? And one answer, of course, is in a legal system. You create a constitution and a bill of rights, a legal system, a court system, that attempts, through a rational legal process, to grant freedom to everyone equally. And it, yeah.
That's the healthcare debate.
That's exactly
that. That is the healthcare debate. Yeah. Along with many other debates. Many other.
That's really fresh. I look at it as lens.
Yeah. And it's intriguing because, on the one hand, this constitution has endured for well over 200 years. I mean, there's something astonishing and wonderful about it. On the other hand, does the legal system ultimately provide freedom in a deeper sense for us? And you're shaking your head.
I don't view the Constitution as granting freedom. It tries to grant a certain equality of rights.
Yes.
Which is a little different than assumption that man, if he is given certain rights or certain, I'll use the word freedom now, will act rationally.
Yes.
And I am increasingly questioning that assumption.
Yes.
And that involves things like, you know, if you're educated, if you understand this, you will respond in a certain way, and I just don't believe it anymore.
Yes. Yes. And I can look at my own life, which has been immensely privileged. Lots of education, PhD, the whole works. And I can say what with St. Paul, you know, what exactly where I'm going. And so this is where the Ogozozin is trying to take us, or where Dostoevsky is trying to take us in book six, which feels like a massive digression, but is in a sense the philosophical or theological center of the novel. Because freedom is found, I mean, Constitution and rights can give one the space.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying. It can give one the space to pursue one's own desires, whatever it might be. Right? Inalienable rights.
Mm-hmm.
Inalienable rights. Including
the answer.
That allows us to do that. And what Dostoevsky is saying is, if you really are looking for freedom, well, then you have to go to John 12:24 or 2 Corinthians. There's some kind of transformation, metanoia, whatever word you want to use, that is made possible through the Spirit. This is what Zosima has experienced himself. And part of what we get in book six is Zosima's story. And we find out that Zosima had been a soldier in his younger life, like Dmitri. One reason he bows to Dmitri. He knows Dmitri. He had been a soldier, had abused his servant one day, remembering, abused his servant. He had a younger brother who had been an atheist and then contracted a terminal illness. And shortly before his death, the younger brother had this astonishing opening to Christ. And he went around blessing the birds and asking forgiveness of the birds. I mean, this kind of holy fool thing. And Zosima had listened but kind of dismissed him. There was this memory, this seed. And after Zosima strikes his servant, he's lying awake that night and he remembers his brother and his brother's words. And he breaks down and realizes, my servant is my equal. Here we go. This question about how do you achieve this kind of equality? Is it simply a matter of law and establishing rights and so on? That's certainly important. I'm just trying to speak for Dostoevsky here. Civil rights movement. Absolutely, you want a Supreme Court that says segregation is illegal in this country. But does that solve the problem of racism? It's important. But Martin Luther King is standing not just on a matter of law. He's going to use the law as much as he can, absolutely. But what he's standing on, finally, of course, is something else. Confronting, standing in front of somebody and saying, I am your equal. You can shoot me, you can kill me, but you cannot get me out of here.
But isn't that part of the contract in terms of it's we the people have to defend each other's rights to choose? And that's why you have a Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it may not legislate justice,
right,
but it certainly leaves the space for it to grow.
Precisely.
And
yes.
There's a responsibility that comes with freedom implied in the Constitution, which has been sadly forgotten. But it's like Galatians. It's not for license.
No.
But for responsibility.
Yes. And that responsibility and that, you know, ultimately, and again, I'm just trying to speak for Dostoevsky here, that responsibility and desire to care for or be accountable to another person, ultimately, he's arguing, is a matter of the Spirit. you can try to legislate it. You can try to teach it as a parent and say, this is the right thing to do versus the wrong thing to do. But there's some fundamental inner sense, he's saying. Because,
you have the government, and you have civilization. Yes. And the Constitution and the Bill of Rights really only stops the government from restricting people's rights.
Correct.
Civilization has to grow and change on its own.
Yes.
This helps it. But it's basically two separate things. So your two separate freedoms have to be separate.
Yes. And again, what Dostoevsky's trying to raise is, how does civilization do this? And he's looking at what we think of as Western civilization and saying, how good a job has it done? In certain ways, a good job. In other ways, from his point of view, it's never going to get at the core issue. Because for him, the core issue is a spiritual issue, finally. It's a spiritual issue.
Well, it's kind of like this. I think people talk about freedom as the lack of constraint, the lack of obligations.
Yes.
I can do whatever I want, whenever I want, no one's going to bother me, and it's really impossible to be free in that kind of a mindset, because it is obligation and commitment and covenant which actually gives us freedom.
And that, in a way, is the key question that we're bumping up against. What is it that brings freedom? What is it that brings freedom? And again, from Dostoevsky's point of view, and this is what we're going to be seeing, this is what happens to Zosima, to go back to that story. He has a breakdown. In a sense, he falls. He's aware that he's fallen. He has struck his servant. And what does he do? He goes back to the servant. I think we've got 5 minutes. We're going to finish this book.
Not in this lifetime.
I guess we're all just going to stay another week. What Zosima does is he goes to a servant and bows to the servant and says, forgive me. And the servant is horrified, really. Wait a minute. We have a hierarchical relationship. We have a culture. You are abandoning the entire culture, the military culture, et cetera, et cetera. And Zosima steps outside of it. And he's supposed to be fighting a duel later that day. And he goes out, and he's going to fight the duel, and he shoots his pistol up in the air, because he knows if he shows up and says, I don't want to fight the duel, everybody's going to say, you're a coward. So he stands there, he fires his pistol, and stands there and lets the guy shoot at him. And then he goes into the monastery. There's this radical shift that he experiences. And so his story comes out of that, and this is the way one of these sections ends. And this should be, I think, on your handout, page 319 and 320. At the bottom of 319, he says, about 6-7 lines up on 319, anyone, even a wicked man, can love by chance. My young brother asked forgiveness of the birds. It seems senseless, yet it is right. For all is like an ocean. All flows and connects. Touch it in one place, and it echoes at the other end of the world. Talk about it, call it an ecological understanding of things. Touch it in one place, and it echoes at the other end of the world. We are responsible for one another. Right now, whatever's going on in Africa or the Middle East, name the place, we are responsible. This is why he says we must ask forgiveness for all. We are implicated. And of course, we're beginning to understand that. When I go to the store and buy a shirt made in China or wherever it might be, I am involved in other people's lives. This is what Zosima is saying. All is like an ocean. Let it be madness to ask forgiveness of the birds. And the birds, of course, is part of this whole system. Still, it will be easier for the birds and for a child and for any animal near you if you yourself were more gracious than you are now, if only by a drop. Still, it would be easier. All is like an ocean, I say to you. Tormented by universal love, you too would then start praying to the birds as if in a sort of ecstasy. Top of 320. And entreat them to forgive you your sin. Cherish this ecstasy, however senseless it seems to people. I'm going to skip down to about the middle of that page, 320. Let's see. There is much in the strongest feelings and impulses of our nature that we cannot comprehend while on earth. About the middle of page 320. There's a lot we can't understand, but don't be tempted by that. Do not think it can serve you as a justification for anything. The eternal judge will demand of you that which you could comprehend, and so on. And then this line, and the rest of this paragraph. But on earth we are indeed wandering, as it were. And did we not have the precious image of Christ before us, we would perish and be altogether lost, like the race of men before the flood. This notion of the image of Christ, this is the icon, this is that incarnation, this sense of we have actually been shown how we are to live. And how do we manage to follow it? Is it simply by establishing dogma and rules, which are useful, certainly, but is that the nature of the transformation? Or is there something deeper than that that happened to those disciples that turned their world upside down and has turned lives upside down for 2,000 years since? It's a radical call at its fundamental level. And it's through this image that this can happen. Much on earth is concealed from us, but in place of it, we have been granted a secret, mysterious sense of our living bond with the other world, with the higher heavenly world, and the roots of our thoughts and feelings are not here, but in other worlds. That is why philosophers say it is impossible on earth to conceive the essence of things. God took seeds from other worlds and sowed them on this earth and raised up his garden, and everything that could sprout, sprouted. But it lives and grows only through its sense of being in touch with other mysterious worlds. If this sense is weakened or destroyed in you, that which has grown up in you dies. You become indifferent to life and even come to hate it. And lots of critics have said, that paragraph, that's the center of the novel. This notion of roots, a paradox again. Roots we think of as being in the earth, but ultimately we are rooted in some sense, some awareness that transcends, actually, our more limited perspective. Some sense. However you want to try to understand that, there's some very deep feeling, awareness that we have of this transcendent reality. And it's that has to be the foundation. This is what Zosimus will say. Everything has to come from that place. Otherwise, it's just trying to manipulate through rules and obligations, whatever it might be. It has to come from this profound act of love that leads to a place of gratitude. Grace and gratitude are etymologically related. You experience grace, and what is your response? Gratitude. And gratitude is a spilling over. You want to do something for someone else when you've experienced grace. It's from that place that the real healing is going to come, which is what Dostoevsky and the rest of the novel is going to try to show us. And where I wanted to get to today was the next book, which is Alyosha's Big Crisis. And to me, it's the shortest book, and also the most beautiful, the most powerful. And so that, again, is my teaser for you. So we'll do that tomorrow, and then move on.